Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Worksman's Part 2 session of the current webinar series. We are delighted that you've joined us again this morning. We do note that there are still people coming into the room and joining. However, it is already 5 past 10. So we do think it's appropriate to commence. I'm Amor Burger-Smit, and I'll be facilitating the session this morning. We started the previous session with the webinar on data protection and privacy with the aim to actually delve down in a bit more detail as to what POPIA actually means and how it should be interpreted and applied on a day-to-day basis. So the aim indeed is not just to give another POPI webinar where we reflect the legislation, but to unpack and explore the complicated aspects of what POPIA means on a day-to-day basis. So if we look at the next slide, thank you, Kayuri. The aim of the webinar is indeed not to make you cry, but as it ought to be hopefully interpreted and seen as an enabler to understand and unpack the legislation. During the first part of the webinars, we dealt with consent as the first topic. Today we'll move over and delve into legitimate interest as a lawful basis for processing. Previously, if we can go back, Kayuri, please. Jock dealt with the employer-employee relationship, if we consider and apply the legislation to that relationship, which is so important to understand and unpack in our country and in our legal landscape, where we focused previously on the relationship understanding from a POPIA perspective in detail. Today, Jock will deal with a far more practical application as a follow-on from his previous introduction from an employee-employer relationship in light of POPIA. Neil Kirby presented during the first part of this Worksman series on the information officer and what that entails and how we ought to be thinking about the appointment of an information officer. Today, you will deal with a very important topic being focusing on special personal information and what the legislation requires of us to actually consider and understand when we're focusing on something like special personal information. Tracy dealt previously with data breaches and gave us a detailed overview of where do we stand from both the legislation, but also practically what we're experiencing worldwide from a data breach perspective. Today, Tracy will deal with the cyber bill. Now, cyber crime is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and we cannot ignore the fact that it links directly to data protection. So we trust that today we'll give you further detail and insight into what the Worksman's view and approach to the implementation of POPIA in our clients' businesses, your businesses, as well as our philosophy in applying the legislation. For further detail on the Worksman's data protection practice, please feel free to visit the Worksman's website, where you'll get further detail on the team, our solutions that we're rolling out, a lot of those tech-driven, because we believe that is the new way to approach these aspects, and the general approach of the Worksman's team. You will note that you can make use of the Q&A function on the page, just in terms of household rules. We request that you please post your questions on the Q&A section of the page, which we will then deal with. Our approach this morning will be that we will have the four topics presented. After each topic, we will indeed allow for an opportunity, a question opportunity. We do realize, and following the part one of this webinar series, that there are a lot of questions and there's a lot of interest in what POPIA actually means. We have therefore decided to publish a document that you will, I'll give you further detail on that a bit later during the course of the morning. So I think we can do, we've got time constraints and therefore move over at this stage to the first presentation. It's important to note that each presentation will last around about 15 minutes. I will provide for a 5 to 7 minute question session, and any additional questions, if you've got time at the end of the webinar, we will be dealing with that. So this morning, I am indeed, I'm Amorbo Besmit, and I'll be presenting the first topic to everyone this morning. And the topic, as I've said, consent and justification, legitimate interest. Where does this leave us? Now, previously, and I think the next slide, if we discuss lawful processing, previously we discussed the concept of lawful processing, and one of the first and most important elements when we consider lawful processing is indeed, what are the legal grounds if considering lawful processing? If we think about lawful processing, there are 6 distinct grounds that allows for lawful processing. Where we dealt with consent the previous webinar session and highlighted the shortcomings of the consent as a basis for lawful processing, today we will be dealing with legitimate interest, which allows far more maneuvering space for companies when we think about lawful processing. Consent inherently has got shortcomings, and Jacques will deal with it when we focus on employment. But for instance, in the employer-employee relationship, it's been accepted internationally that consent is an absolutely inappropriate basis for lawful processing. And you might ask yourself why. Now, the reason is it is deemed an inappropriate basis because there's an imbalance in the relationship. An employee doesn't really have the ability to say no and deny the employer consent. And that unequal relationship and the scale that's unbalanced makes consent a very problematic basis for processing. And then also the fact that consent can be withdrawn at any minute. So we need to consider what is lawful and what is appropriate if we deal with consent, and then consider the balancing of power. So I am going to present to you, and you'll see on the next slide, very wordy slides, but the idea is for us, once we've dealt with lawful processing and the basis for that, to understand that there are certain core aspects that actually inform the whole issue if we consider lawful processing. Now, first of all, we can't understand and we can't unpack lawful processing if we don't just first look at it from a data subject right perspective, because data subjects do have rights, and how does that impact on lawful processing? And it's important that we keep that in the background when we want to unpack lawful processing. Number one, data subjects have got a right to be informed what we will be doing with their personal information, how we will be processing their personal information. Therefore, if we want to rely on legitimate interest, we need to be able to communicate to data subjects, and it's their right to know what this legitimate interest actually is that we want to achieve in processing their personal information. A privacy policy or privacy notice therefore becomes very important. Secondly, a data subject's got a right to the information to be erased, to be deleted. That's also referred to as the right to be forgotten from an EU perspective. Now, when we consider legitimate interest, it is noteworthy to realize that a data subject do not necessarily have the right to have his or her or its data deleted and erased, because it depends on what is the legitimate interest of the responsible party, i.e. the company, or then a third party to hold on to that information. And there's a balancing test that will have to be applied. And there's sufficient international jurisprudence for us to actually understand and unpack that from a legal perspective. In the third instance, We know a data subject's got the right to object to his data being processed, but if you consider legitimate interest as a lawful basis for processing, the data subject does not necessarily have the ability to insist on his or her or its data being deleted and not further processed anymore. Again, it centers around a balancing test. So exercising that balancing test becomes very important. And the fourth aspect that I wish to highlight, if we unpack the POPIA and in terms of legitimate interest, we know that you can't rely on legitimate interest for purposes of transborder transfer of personal information. Now, on the next two slides, what I thought I'll do is to give everyone a view as to what has been accepted in the EU and in terms of the GDPR as aspects linking or examples of legitimate interest actions undertaken. Now, direct marketing is such a contentious issue, and there's a lot of debate at the moment around direct marketing and what it actually entails and where the boundaries are and how do we reach our customers, how do we market to our customers. Direct marketing has been recognized in Recital 47 as a potential legitimate interest that you can process personal data lawfully for purposes of direct marketing on the basis of legitimate interest, i.e. the company's got a legitimate interest in marketing its products. Now, I do believe this is going to be assessed carefully in South Africa if we listen to what the information regulator has been saying about direct marketing and that it is a contentious issue. But if we look at legitimate interest and we want to understand it, we need to realize one thing. We need to determine whether it is the reasonable or whether we can deem it as the reasonable expectation of the data subject to be for their personal information to be processed in a manner that we as companies would deem to be a legitimate interest. And what is the relationship is between the company and the data subject? So something like fraud prevention, if further processing of personal information is required for fraud prevention purposes. For instance, you know, if we consider something like verifying the registered address, Kagiri, just go back to the previous slide, please. The registered address of a cardholder to determine whether that is indeed the same as the cardholder's normal place of residence of work. That is strictly necessary or can be deemed strictly necessary. But more importantly also, or also important, if we look at multinational companies, global entities making use of central depositories or centralizing systems from an organizational design perspective, affiliate companies with a central body where information is being processed in their central body, that has been accepted in the EU that indeed we are in a situation where personal information can be then transferred into this central body and the central body can then process the information. Also networks and security information. And if we move over to the next slide, if we delve a bit deeper into fraud prevention as a legitimate interest, that has been accepted as a core legitimate interest, not only of the responsible party, but also of the data subject and third parties. Because if we consider insurance companies, fraud prevention is very important because fraud impacts at the end of the day on premiums that we all pay. So fraud prevention has been accepted as a legitimate interest. Risk assessment and overall risk assessment to determine, do we take on customers, do we take on clients, has been accepted as a legitimate interest. Due diligence processes in considering necessary on the take on of customers or potential customers or business partners and processing information in relation to that is another ground that has been accepted as a legitimate interest ground for lawful processing. Then individual rights, and this is an interesting concept for me. So the data subject, the individual, has got the right to object to his information being processed. He's got the right to request for his information to be erased, to be deleted. Now, a company might not have put that in the data privacy policy initially. So initially, it was not foreseen and it was not stated that data will be processed in that way or manner. However, it is in the legitimate interest of both the company, the responsible party, as well as the data subject, that that processing activity takes place because the data subject requested for his information to be deleted. Network security. In processing personal information for purposes of network security undoubtedly constitutes a legitimate interest. Now, on the next two slides, I'm presenting to all of you a case study. And the case study focuses, we introduced in part one of the webinar series, telematics as a case example. So telematics, tracing vehicles, monitoring driver behavior, monitoring driver safety. And if we click through, we can ask ourselves the question whether telematics can constitute a legitimate interest. And there might indeed be a legitimate interest for businesses to safeguard their vehicles, the use of fuel on the vehicles, how the vehicles are being operated, whether the vehicles are on accidents, and whether it is protected by the driver. And if we go through and click through the presentation and carry on to the next two slides, I see Kayuri missed the little circle. Kayuri, thank you. So if we unpack telematics from assessing legitimate interest, I have reflected that on this very wordy screen, but please don't be concerned. The presentations will be made available on request and you can carefully read through this. So where's the example that we learn from when we consider legitimate interest? And I've got 3 minutes left. We can learn from a data protection perspective from the EU and how legitimate interest is applied and assessed from an EU perspective. I'll give you three case examples historically how we've dealt with it, the concept of legitimate interest in South Africa as well. But unpacking legitimate interest from a data protection perspective and specifically in relation and comparing it to the GDPR, there are six core questions to be asked to determine whether you do have a legitimate interest. Question one, what is the purpose of the processing? That is always the most important question to ask. If we apply it to vehicle tracking and telematics, obviously, we know the purpose is to track this vehicle to understand what is going on. And in order to track it, we need to process information. It's as simple as that. The second question on the screen is the processing necessary to meet one or more organizational company objectives? Yes, obviously it's necessary because we want to monitor the usage of our vehicles, the safety of our drivers. We want to monitor how they operate the vehicles and whether they are in accidents and how that can be interpreted. Now the question is, in order to achieve this objective, do we actually need to process the information? Is it absolutely required to achieve this lawful objective? And then we need to assess the legitimate interest and whether it is in the interest of the customers as well. Now, remember one thing, and it's very important when we consider legitimate interest. Not every desire of a company can be deemed a legitimate interest. Therefore, at the end of the day, it calls for a balancing test. The third question you need to ask is this in the legitimate interest of any third party, potentially? You know, safety of road users, or then if we think about warranties on vehicles or the third party contractors involved in the process, we can then determine whether it might be in their legitimate interest. Or if we consider in the EU, we do have the concept that certain, as I've just reflected on the previous slide, certain aspects of business actions have already been identified as a legitimate interest. Now, unfortunately, in South Africa, We're not that fortunate. We do not have the privilege of a list of things that we already know can be deemed legitimate interest. We do, however, have the good fortune that our legislation provides that we ought to take into consideration what happens in other jurisdictions. Therefore, we can rely on what the EU has said previously. So let's take comfort in terms of that. The recitals in recital 47 in terms of the GDPR. And then we need to determine, why is it important? Why is it absolutely important from a responsible party's perspective to actually, why is it business critical for the responsible party to process this information? And then the last question is, why is it important for third parties? Now, I want to quote this morning, because I thought it is important for us to understand that it's not a new concept in South Africa. I'll give you three quick examples. Historically, 1995, in the State versus Makwanyane, the learned judge said, what is material is that the law applies a proportionality test, weighing the interest protected against the interest of the wrongdoer. Same applies from a data privacy perspective if we deal with legitimate interest. Remember, the right to privacy is not an absolute right, but we need to weigh it up against the other rights afforded in terms of the Constitution to us as citizens in this country. In 2002, Christian Lawyers Association versus National Minister of Health and others, the learned judge said, the state has an important and legitimate interest in the preservation and protection of the health and welfare of the woman herself. And then it went on to say, when its interest in doing so becomes sufficiently compelling, it allows for and warrants intrusion, and therefore a balancing test to be applied. And this was also confirmed just the other day in 2002 in Kumalo versus Ulemisa, where the learned judge said, and an appropriate balance is struck between the protection of freedom of expression on the one hand and the value of human dignity on the other. The right to privacy directly impacts our human dignity. And where our courts have determined that this balancing act must take place, we need to realize that if we consider legitimate interest, a balancing of rights must take place. And that's how we assess how a company, the responsible party, can rely on legitimate interest to process personal information without undue interaction or obstruction by a data subject. Thank you very much. This is the end of the presentation on legitimate interest. We will have a quick look at potential questions. We've got a couple of questions. The first one, can I ask if fraud prevention is seen as a legitimate interest? And would that allow processing of special personal information to private non-profit organizations that have been established to detect and prevent fraud? So we do know one thing, that fraud prevention has been identified in the EU as a specific ground for processing as a, on the basis of legitimate interest. Special personal information, and Neil will deal with this a bit later, so let me not move into that space at this stage. But remember one thing, special personal information, as a general rule, you require consent to process it. But let's leave this question. We'll deal with it further during Neil's presentation as well. The next question that followed is, will the recording video... Oh, no, sorry. They just want to know that. Great. Sorry, wonderful. Okay, that was the only question in detail. And we will now move over to the next presentation to allow and respect everyone's time that they put in for purposes of presentation to Jock's presentation. And I hand over to Jock. Your 15 minutes starts now. Thank you.
Thank you, Amol. Thank you all. In part one of the webinar, I identified the personal information and special personal information that is typically processed during the employment life cycle And what was clear from that is that there is a significant flow of personal information from the recruitment stage right through to the termination stage, between the employer and the employee, and even to third parties. I think what is also clear is that there are a number of laws that intersect and interact with POPIA and the employment relationship and place various obligations on an employer to process and further process not only the an employee's personal information, but also his or her special personal information. So in part two, I thought I'd demonstrate practically how POPIA and these various laws interact by reference to a hypothetical situation, a hypothetical employer, no reflection of anyone out there, and to see how that the law interacts with its employees. So in this example, ABC Pty Limited is a multinational company. It has a local office in the Western Cape. It employs several hundred employees in South Africa. It also has office access regulated by fingerprint and facial recognition systems. So ABC processes credit information on behalf of its customers, and its employees will obviously have access to that information during their day-to-day tasks. When ABC has a vacancy, it typically uses a recruitment agency. In this case, we'll call it Recruitment ABC, but sometimes it also does its own recruitment. It stores the majority of its customers' information, as well as its personnel's information, digitally using cloud-based systems, and the servers for those cloud-based systems are based in Norway. ABC is also of the required size and complexity to be designated as an employer in terms of the Employment Equity Act. And it has recently commenced on a recruitment drive in terms of its newly adopted affirmative action policy. ABC offers its employees a medical aid scheme as well as a provident fund and requires their membership. It's compulsory. It comes with your employment. ABC, as a good corporate citizen, has prepared its employment equity plan. It's a five-year plan, and it submits its report whenever it is required to do so. Before employing employees, by reason of the work that they do and the people they have access to, ABC requires all its employees to undergo credit and criminal checks. And require some of them to undergo psychometric tests to see how they fit into certain positions. Some of its employees, for the purpose of this example, are drivers who must undergo eye tests annually and must be tested for alcohol consumption on a random basis. So if we look at how POPIA interacts and we move to the next slide, we will see that firstly, ABC is a responsible party from a POPIA point of view. It processes personal and special personal information of its employees, the data subjects in this relationship. It must therefore comply with the eight principles of lawful processing of personal information. So let's look at each of the examples within the hypothetical case. If we consider firstly the credit and criminal checks. Now, there's no legal obligation to disclose this information to ABC in the current scenario. There is, however, as you will recall from what Lamore said, there is definitely a legitimate interest which ABC has in this information. It needs to be sure that it's employing people who are not likely or have a propensity to commit fraud or theft, in view of the fact that ABC works with credit records of its customers, which possibly entail having access to financial resources as well. This is a legitimate basis to obtain and process the information regarding to credit checks and criminal checks. Before gathering this information, it is advisable though that ABC should advise the applicants why it needs this information. It should ensure that the employees can access this information once it's gained, if necessary, to correct it. It's not unusual for information from credit bureaus to sometimes be erroneous. So there's a need for access to correct or to replace or update. It must also ensure that it stores this information securely and processes it only for the purposes it was collected. In this case, to ensure that the employee is the appropriate person for the job. So if the employee fulfills a position, for example, not involving the access to sensitive financial resources, not requiring a high level of trust, it may be that ABC does not, in fact, have a legitimate interest in obtaining that information from a credit bureau in regard to that employee. If we then turn to ABC's employment equity obligations, many of us are employed by employers who have these obligations, and as we know, it requires the gathering of a lot of special personal information. As I pointed out, ABC is a designated employer, and therefore, in terms of the Employment Equity Act, must process special personal information of its employees in relation to their race, gender, and disability, at least. The processing of this information is lawful and required by law because the Employment Equity Act requires ABC to collect and to further process this information. This information has to be captured into a report and submitted on an ongoing basis to various authorities. So the further processing in this instance is required by law and therefore permissible. It may not, however, ABC that is, further process this information for a purpose not contemplated by the Employment Equity Act or, for instance, its affirmative action policy and plan. Here, one would have to look at obtaining the express specific consent of the employees, and it must be for a legitimate purpose. So as I mentioned, ABC has an affirmative action policy. An affirmative action policy requires that decisions made regarding promotion and recruitment consider the gender, race, and disability of the applicants and the employees. Processing of the race and ethnic origin information in this instance is therefore necessary. The question then is it lawful and is it required by law or legitimate interest? And I think we will all agree that now context in view of the need to address past inequalities of previously disadvantaged groups, not only is it a legitimate pursuit on the part of ABC and most employers who have these policies, but it is also contemplated as being fair and lawful, both in terms of the Employment Equity Act and the Labor Relations Act. So again, we have an intersection of several acts in this particular case. Some of ABC's employees are also members of a financial services trade union. I thought I'd just add this to further complicate the matter, which has secured organizational rights at ABC. So ABC has agreed with this trade union that it will collect union dues from its members who are employees of ABC and will submit a monthly schedule to the union, which sets out the amount deducted from each employee in respect of each of the members of this trade union. In so doing, ABC discloses personal information to the trade union relating to remuneration, name, ID, and so on. Typically, employees would agree to these deductions when they sign a stop order or a membership form in favor of the trade union. In so doing, the processing and further processing of this information is permissible. In regard to psychometric testing, the Employment Equity Act regards this as a form of medical testing and therefore strictly controls it. Psychometric tests are typically administered to certain employees to assess whether, from a personality and other behavioral traits point of view, they will slot in and be compatible. For this reason, it is to be treated with some degree of caution. Psychometric tests and the information obtained must be for a legitimate purpose as well as a lawful purpose under the Employment Equity Act. When it comes to eye checks, I mentioned that some of the drivers were required to undergo eye checks, and that in turn generates medical information, which is special personal information, and undergo blood alcohol tests or breathalyzer tests, which once again produces this type of information. The question is whether this is permitted and whether this would be lawfully processed or further processed. Again, the notion of legitimate interest, but also legal obligation, come to the fore here. The Occupational Health and Safety Act requires that an employer provide the employees with a safe working environment and ensure that those persons who operate certain machinery are able to do so. The obtaining of this information is regarded as a medical test, as I've mentioned, and therefore must only be collected in certain circumstances. The Basic Conditions of Employment Act also requires that the employer takes steps to ensure that the workplace is safe. So to collect this information for the specific purpose of ensuring that the operators of machinery do so safely and drivers are able to see where they're going would therefore be not only a legitimate interest on the part of the employer, but a lawful obligation which it must comply. And therefore the processing and further processing of this information is permissible. If we then move to the next slide, we know that we see that ABC has decided to engage in a recruitment drive, as I mentioned. It has advertised vacant positions and it has requested information necessary for finding the best candidates. In terms of its affirmative action policy, it aims to employ primarily Black female graduates because it has identified a gap in its employment and employee profile in that area. Applicants are therefore required, according to its advertisement, to disclose both their gender and race, as well, of course, as academic qualifications. The question is this lawful processing? Well, affirmative action is a legitimate and lawful pursuit in South Africa. It is contemplated by the Employment Equity Act. It is also contemplated by the Labor Relations Act, which specifically permits fair discrimination on the basis of race and gender in order to address previous disadvantaged groups and anomalies and inequalities. ABC also has a legitimate interest in obtaining the applicant's academic qualifications. It must recruit persons not only who achieve the affirmative action goals, but who have the required skills for the position. ABC should nonetheless be transparent about why the special personal information is being sought and disclosed in this advertisement. In regard to unsuccessful applicants, the information supplied by them must be kept for no longer than required by law. Here, it may be that those applicants require ABC or request ABC to hold on to their applications in case other jobs arise. I also mentioned that ABC had an access control system and that it required not only two fingerprints, but also facial recognition software. The gathering of this information is personal information. The processing of this information is therefore also subject to the provisions of POPIA. This information must therefore be gathered for a legitimate or lawful process. So for instance, when would that no longer be a legitimate gathering of information? Well, if the employee leaves the employment of the employer, that will no longer be lawful or justifiable to continue to process that information. ABC will, as you can imagine, also retain information of employees who've left, and that again must be asked, why would you require that information? And there must be a legitimate or lawful purpose for doing so. I see I'm running out of time, but you will understand from this hypothetical that at every step of the process, ABC must process personal information of its employees and must comply with POPIA. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jock. Thank you, Jock. Indeed, a wonderful interpretation and breakdown and further delve into the concept of something like legitimate interest and how we also, the law impacts on how we deal with Papua and the rest of the world and the rest of the legal landscape, was because we cannot interpret and apply privacy legislation in isolation. This is not an island we're sitting on. We need to understand how it links to what we do on a day-to-day basis in the broader legal landscape. So I note that there are today no further questions on this, and therefore I will move forward. And Neil, will you please take over and continue with the presentation on special personal information? Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. Good morning, everyone. Following on from what Jacques has said, I thought it would be useful to deal with a particular category of special personal information, one that is relatively contentious due to the content of the information that is involved, and that is health-related information. Obviously, I have an interest in health-related information as my practice area is healthcare and life sciences. So I have been trying to grapple with what PAPEA actually means for the processing of health-related information. It's also a great opportunity to test the regulatory fabric of PAPEA in respect of how practically it is endeavoring to protect information whilst at the same time allow for the processing of the information. So it's a classic case of PAPEA giveth and PAPEA taketh away. The point here is to understand if, when it comes to health-related information, the protections offered are adequate. And if there's not too little in the way of overall protection of health-related information, that brings into question whether or not PAPEA is taking the protection of health-related information seriously. So moving on to the next slide, the section that I'm fundamentally going to focus on is section 32. And section 32 deals with the circumstances in which health-related information may in fact be processed. It deals with health or sex life, generally speaking, but there are also certain other categories of information that are referred to uniquely in this particular section. The overall principle is that health or sex life related information may not be processed. And that comes out of section 26. So there Poppy giveth. Now in section 32, I'm afraid it does seem to taketh away a bit in relation to how your health related information is processed. The one other aspect about this particular investigation is that it affects every one of us, because every one of us at some point has had to generate or has generated health related information. And I think you would be surprised, maybe not, at how much health related information you have generated over your lifetime, and also who in fact has already seen that health related information. So we have an overall prohibition, which gives us some degree of comfort. But moving on to the next slide, there are a number of people who are entitled to have a look at your health related information and who are recognized from a statutory point of view as being able to process the health related information about you, notwithstanding the overall prohibition in section 26. So obviously it makes sense that medical professionals, hospitals, social services are entitled to process your health information. The caveat there though is that it must be for the proper treatment and care of the patient concerned. That does run into difficulties in relation to the application of other pieces of legislation dealing with the way in which health-related information may be transferred. So the National Health Act, for example, recognizes an overall confidentiality of health-related information, but also states that your health-related information without your consent may be provided to another healthcare provider for purposes of your treatment. Insurance companies, medical schemes administrators, and managed care organizations also have a right to process your health information, And I think you'll agree that that makes sense. You are relying, obviously, on the ability of a medical scheme and its cohort to process your claims in order for you to gain access to healthcare services where you are a member of a medical scheme. Schools are entitled to process health-related information, but only where special support is required by a pupil. Please bear in mind that a lot of these terms are unique to Section 32 and are not defined in PAPEA. So we have a lot of work to do in relation to understanding how Section 32 is going to apply in effect. And I think that that's one of the problems with Section 32. Information relating to the management of the care of a child may be processed. Any public body managing a prison or detention center, where obviously healthcare services are provided within that facility. And then administrative bodies, which would include pension funds, employers, or institutions working for them in respect of the implementation of particular laws or support for employees. So we have a raft, fundamentally, of people who are entitled to process information, notwithstanding an overall prohibition in Section 26. And it's important, I think, for us as individuals to understand how and who we are dealing with when receiving or placing ourselves in a healthcare situation, in relation especially to the movement of our personal information and the sensitivity of all of that information and how we would like to have it protected. Under the next slide, that all having been said, there is a provision in PAPEA that takes away a little bit from the overall rights of those entities I've just referred to actually process healthcare information, and it talks about an obligation of confidentiality. It is an interesting limitation that is imposed by Section 32. It says that that obligation of confidentiality may arise in certain circumstances, and it recognizes by virtue of office, employment, professional legal right, or an established written contract. Now, that's all very well and good, but the difficulty that one faces practically is that I, as a patient and a member of a medical scheme, have only a relationship with my medical scheme. I do not have a relationship with anyone else who might process that information. That then means that there has to be a rejigging almost of the chain of people who have access to my healthcare information on the basis that obligations of confidentiality would need to be imposed along that entire chain, beginning with me, the patient member, or just with me, the patient. So there needs to be a careful consideration of a host of legal enactments that run around the provision of healthcare in South Africa, bearing in mind we have a thing called the Health Professions Act, which requires the registration of our doctors, but we also have things like the Allied Health Professions Act that deals with people like chiropractors and homeopaths. We have the Nursing Act, we have the Pharmacy Act, and we have codes of conduct under each of those pieces of legislation that deal also with issues of confidentiality, but that's where it ends. And to a large degree, a number of the people referred to in that list I provided are operating without necessarily an obligation of confidentiality. The Section 32 then sort of wanders off a little bit, and it talks about the ability of those people that I've referred to processing health or related information on a confidential basis. So it layers over in another section an obligation of confidentiality that appears to arise from a statutory source, being Section 32.3. And that then begs the question of the interaction between Section 32.3 and Section 32. And what's happening is that there's a complex creation here of obligations that arise and then seem to be limited at the same time. And the scope and ambit of those obligations are going to have to be sorted out in some form or another in order to understand how PAPEA is trying to protect personal information. And as a case study, it is an interesting observation that whilst there is on the face of it at first blush an obvious protection of personal information, my argument is that I don't believe necessarily once you begin interrogating what is happening in Papia, that we can all sit and rest assured that our personal information in respect of healthcare is necessarily and entirely protected by Papia. I said that Section 32 wandered off. It then, to the next slide, deals with something called inherited characteristics. This is a separate and discrete category of personal information or special personal information. And it talks about an overall prohibition of processing information about a data subject's inherited characteristics. We have no idea what that actually means in respect of its scope and its ambit, but it would presumably go to something along the lines of what it is that you have inherited from your parents and how that may be influencing your current state of health. That would go to the ability potentially of insurance companies to underwrite certain risks in respect of persons insured. And the difficulty that arises is that there is no speaking between Section 32.5 and the overall allowance made in Section 32.4 insurance companies, for example. But there are two possible qualifications, and that is where a serious medical interest prevails. It is unclear what a serious medical interest is and how that will be assessed for purposes of applying Section 32 and when such a serious medical interest will prevail. Serious medical interests could range all the way from matters of emergency to certain catastrophic events, which would include a diagnosis of a terminal or terminal illness. And then the further qualification is for historical, statistical, and a research activity. So at the end of the day, whilst there is an overall prohibition on in 32.5 on inherited characteristics, the difficulty that we have is that there seems to be more a let than there is a prohibition. Just before we move away from Papia, going to the next slide, there is the interaction that we have to worry about with the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Information is available to me as an individual if I want to request it pursuant to Condition 8 of PAPIA as a data subject participation principle. The difficulty, though, is that whilst I'm allowed in terms of PAPIA to request all of my healthcare information from anybody who I believe is holding it, I have to do that via the provisions of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. That means that there's a relatively awkward collision between PAPIA and PAIA, insofar as anyone holding my healthcare information would be entitled to deal with my request with reference to the provisions of PAIA. And PAIA spends quite a bit of time dealing with how healthcare information may be requested and accessed in Section 25. And that the difficulty that one faces there is that in order for a request under PAIA, going to the next slide, to be dealt with, there is a particular process that is applied to healthcare-related information. And the one aspect that is of interest is that healthcare-related information may be refused where it would cause serious harm to my physical or mental health or well-being. Now, there are a number of issues that arise in the healthcare sector that allow for a medical practitioner to withhold information from me. It's called therapeutic privilege. And that information is withheld from me because if I knew about that information, I would probably, in all likelihood, refuse otherwise needed healthcare treatment. Now, the difficulty there is that there is going to have to be some degree of interrogation of my own healthcare information before it's given to me by somebody who is able to decide whether or not that information in my hands is going to cause more of a problem than it is going to be of a benefit. So the movement of healthcare information, even as between myself and my healthcare provider, is a relatively complex and convoluted arrangement, and one that may be problematic from a limitation point of view under PAPIA. But it is something that one is required to explore, and we are in the process, in fact, throughout the healthcare sector, both public and private, looking at the relationship between requesting and protecting healthcare-related information. It's not the easiest process in the world, and it is one that I think is going to have some very drastic changes and consequences for both public and private healthcare. That's a mouthful, I'm really sorry, but are there any questions?
Neil, at this stage, no, we do not have any questions. I think just while people may still be contemplating questions, I would like to suggest that if we consider all of what you've just said, and it is so important, again, to link the legislation and all the provisions of this papier legislation to, for instance, the prior legislation. Just as we've got 12 months to prepare and to comply with papier, we also still wait for Section 114 to be enacted. And we know there's still a 12-month period for the Human Rights Commission and the Information Regulator to address certain aspects around PIA and PAPIA and how we're going to interpret those together. So we're talking and we're preparing in a phase, if we consider this very important topic you've raised, where we don't know what's going to appear on the canvas still. We're still waiting for that. And that in itself is problematic, isn't it?
It is, because the one thing that emerges from Section 32 is are the practicalities of rearranging your contractual arrangements and looking again at confidentiality. And I appreciate that there's been a discussion about legitimate interest. But the one aspect that Section 32 seems to be completely agnostic to is legitimate interest. It does not refer to that concept in the folds of Section 32. And I wonder if, in fact, Section 32 is a little bit of an outlier in the papier landscape.
I tend to agree with you, because if we're back on the concept of legitimate interest and linking it to special personal information, Section 27 that actually opens the door, that gives a bit of a carve out if we deal with special personal information, does not refer to legitimate interest. And also, if we look at the GDPR and the EU, legitimate interest is dealt with completely differently when and doesn't really form part of the assessment if we deal with special personal information. And that is the instance where consent actually becomes important the moment we focus on special personal information. Another concept that maybe that could be interesting for the audience that I'd appreciate your view on, you know, our legislation, if we look at the definition of a responsible party, refers to the main entity that determines what will happen with the what personal information, the what, the how, the when, or in cooperation with someone, with a third party, which puts us right in the ambit of the EU concept of joint responsible parties, joint processes. So, you know, this the whole dilemma, confidential information, personal information is a subset of confidential information, and then the co-responsible parties. It highlights in my mind, if we talk about health information, the importance of how do we structure our agreements, our responsibilities in papier, and make sure throughout the value chain, everyone understands what papier means and their obligations, isn't it?
Well, it would be. If you think about healthcare generally, the process you go through as a patient is relatively organic. You have a relationship with numerous parties at the point where you access healthcare services. That could range from the medical schemas administrator, the switch that operates for moving claims forward. It's the managed care organization. It's the hospital. It's the nurse. It's the doctor. It is the specialist. When you begin looking at how the healthcare system works in order to provide a service, this is not an easy fit from an information protection point of view. And it's ironic because I would have thought that of all those categories of special personal information that are dealt with in papier, health-related information brings forward the highest risk for the individual concerned. We've already had two decisions in our courts concerning the unlawful disclosure of somebody's HIV status with mandatory compensation as a result. And bearing in mind the civil remedies under PAPEA, there's a good chance that someone's going to trip up and will be sued for money as a result of information moving in the wrong direction.
Indeed, but then we've also got the public interest aspects. And so I would like to suggest, you know, whether you love them or whether you hate them, lawyers are going to be very important going forward interpreting all of this. Because if we consider public interest, you know, we know that our courts have ruled previously and stated that then healthcare information can actually be disclosed because it's in the public interest. So this is an interesting landscape that we find ourselves in. Wonderful. Thank you, Neil. That is a very enlightening topic and valuable, in my view, for our audience. We will now move over to Tracy and continuing on the concept of data breaches and the importance to understand what a data breach is, since it's so prevalent nowadays, to link it to the cybersecurity and the cyber bill, to understand what obligations the cyber bill actually brings to the fore and the implications of that. Because, you know, we said and we believe as the Worksman's team as well, this hand in glove, we cannot look at data protection, data privacy without linking it directly in the way we advise our clients to cybersecurity and the cybersecurity bill, understanding that in the application. Thank you, Tracy. Over to you.
Thanks, Amal. Morning, everyone. So this morning, we're going to focus on cybersecurity and essentially the additional measures which is contemplated under the cybersecurity's bill, the cybercrimes bill, in relation to cybersecurity and the impact on data protection. So moving on, what is cybersecurity? So essentially, we need to focus on the need to protect the information and data which is stored electromagnetically from the unlawful use, accessing, or interference of that data. That is what we're aiming at around from a cybersecurity perspective. How do we go about doing this? So once again, we need to protect your networks. You need to protect your communication networks against any interference from third parties. And companies need to be aware and alert to the fact that there is a possibility for a cyber attack to happen. They need to make sure, specifically when they're interacting with third parties who are bringing systems or goods or services onto their platforms, onto their networks, or who they are allowing access onto a company's IT structure, that they can be exposed to additional risks. Now, lately we've seen a lot of information or a lot of attempts at so-called web domain attacks, at site spoofing attacks, the delivery of malware, of ransomware, of phishing scams going on. And with time, it is just going to get worse. Now, how do we deal with these cyber attacks? What do we need to do? Because the risks of non-compliance, once again, or the risks of having a cyber attack is quite mammoth. You get damages claims. You can be subject to reputational claims. And you can also be subject to a regulatory sanction. So companies need to make sure that they have sufficient measures in place in order to keep their information and their network secure, and they need to be able to respond immediately if there is a breach or a data breach or a cybersecurity attack that they become aware of. How do we do this? We need to plan. So just as in PAPEA, where there was a requirement for you to have a plan in place, a security measures and systems in place, and an incident reporting plan, you need to have the same thing in place in respect from a cybersecurity point of view. You need to plan ahead. You need to be prepared for a possible cyber attack, and you need to have steps in place as to what are you going to do? How are you going to deal with this? How are you going to implement measures to try and stop it going further, or to measures to try and stop it from happening again? And again, as in PAPEA, you need to follow a multidisciplinary approach. It's not just a case of, well, it's an IT issue, an IT department needs to deal with it. You have to have various stakeholders across the company involved in setting up sufficient plans from a security system that you put in place to plans of actions as to what you're going to do when there is a cyber attack going to, when it happens. Again, as in PAPEA, continual maintenance, continual monitoring of your plans is imperative. You need to review and improve your security processes and practices constantly. You need to monitor what new attacks are coming out in the public that you're becoming aware of. Can your company or your network be exposed to such an attack? What measures have you got in place to prevent that? And how can you try and minimize the impact or detect if a cyber attack is going to happen to one of your computer networks? Moving on now to the Cyber Crimes Bill. So what exactly is the purpose around the Cyber Crime Bill? So the bill has basically created certain offenses which has a bearing on cyber crime. It has also gone so far, or the intention is to go and to criminalize the distribution of harmful data messages, to make provision for the protection of interim protection orders, where there is a possibility of data message being sent around, which can have consequences for an individual concern, and also to regulate the power to investigate these so-called cyber crimes. Now, the committee report on the Cyber Crimes Bill was adopted on the 4th of September by the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Supervision. But we do understand that the committee is still scheduled to have further meetings around the bill, so there is as yet no definitive indication of when the bill will possibly be coming forward for further promulgation. What is important to note around the bill is that it does criminalize an identified list of cyber crimes. And these cyber crimes contain or include, there's quite a few of them dealing with specifically data, accessing of data, and then also malicious communication. So of the crimes which they contemplate, first of all, is the unlawful accessing of data. What you need to bear in mind here is that data is not just limited to personal information. Data is defined under the bill as being any type of information which is stored electronically. So you need to make sure that when you're setting up your policies and your security systems, you're not just thinking, well, it's a papier and it goes in hand with that. As much as it does, you've got to have information. You've got to have steps in place to protect all types of information. Now, accessing is considered to be where you are able to access information, where you're able to change information, to amend information, where you're able to move data from one computer to another computer, or where you're able to just hide data on a computer program. That is all considered to be unlawful accessing of information. And what the bill also says is they've defined unlawful accessing as being if your actions exceed your lawful authority to access the information. So it is very, very wide, the scope of the parameter when they contemplate it under the bill in terms of unlawful accessing of data. It also includes unlawful accessing of computer programs, computer data storage medium, or any type of computer system. Next contemplated offense is that of the unlawful interception of data of a non-public nature. And if that data is then given to a third party who is not the owner of that data. What's also important to bear in mind is that the bill goes further to say that if you as an individual are in possession of unlawful data, which has been intercepted unlawfully, you too can be held liable as being in contravention of the act. And in terms of interception, it goes as wide as considering capturing data, viewing data, holding data, or acquiring any form of data. The next contemplated offense is the unlawful acts in respect of software or hardware tools, which can result or be used in the commission of a cybercrime. So this will include using of tools and hardware where you're able to access information, where you can interfere with information or data on a computer program, where you're able to change passwords on a computer program, where you can interfere with the data or a computer network. These are all considered to be unlawful acts in respect to the hardware and software tools. Next is the unlawful interference with data or a computer program. Again, dealing with the unlawful and intentional interference with the data or computer program, where you are able to delete data, where you can interfere with data or damage the data or the computer program to make the information available that's on the program vulnerable, or to change the information on the program, or to make the computer programs ineffective, where you are able to alter data and where you are able to prohibit or deny a company access to their specific information or data or computer programs or systems. This is all contemplated as being unlawful interference. Moving then on to the next slide, additional crimes which are contemplated under the Cyber Crimes Bill is cyber fraud. And what it is contemplated here is when a fraud is committed by means of any data or a computer program, whether it's through the interference of the data or the interference of the computer program or a data storage medium, and as a result of any actual or potential prejudice will be suffered by a third party. The same is contemplated under cyber fraud, forgery, where it contemplates the creation of false data or a false computer program, ultimately with the intention to defraud, and that action will result in any actual or potential prejudice to a third party. Malicious communications. Now, malicious communications actually goes very, very wide. And what you need to take cognizance of is that the scope of this as an offense not only deals with the person who is making available any form of malicious communication, but it also includes a person who distributes that information or who broadcasts that information. So the ambit of the offense contemplated is very large or very wide from a malicious communications point of view. What is considered here is the distribution of data messages with the intention to incite damage, or which will result in the causing of damage to property, or incite violence or threaten against a group of persons. They've also included as an additional offense under malicious communications is when you are distributing, or the intention is to distribute, intimate images of a third party. This is also now falling in the realm of what is viewed as one of the offenses under the Cybercrimes Bill. Moving on. So what is reality? The bill proposes, or the bill contemplates, that if a person unlawfully and intentionally commits a cybercrime or any of the crimes that we've mentioned before, they will be guilty of an offense. It does, however, also go further, and it says any person who induces, who incites, who instructs or procures a person to commit a cybercrime is similarly guilty of an offense. So the scope of what the bill is trying to protect is large, as I said, and particularly around malicious communications. It is not only the person who is making information available, but it's also the person who's distributing it and broadcasting malicious communications that can be subject to an offense under the Cybercrimes Bill. Your offenses can range between 5 to 15 years, depending on the type of offense that has been committed, and it can also result in the imposition of a fine. And the fine that may be imposed is very broad, and essentially it allows for what the court will deem appropriate in terms of Section 276 of the Criminal Procedures Act. What is pertinent to note is that the bill further goes to say that a court, when considering the type of penalty that they may impose, will take into account as aggravating circumstances the fact that this was done by means of electronic medium. They will look at the prejudice which has been suffered by the third party, any loss which they may have suffered, and then they will also look at any gain, whether it's financial or otherwise, which, or any type of favours which has been received by the person who has committed the actual offence. Moving then on to the next slide. So what is the implications for businesses around what's contemplated under the Cybercrimes Bill? So first of all, businesses, electronic communication service providers and financial institutions will now have an obligation to report cybercrimes as soon as they become aware of this cybercrime having occurred. The Act contemplates reports must be made within 72 hours of becoming aware of the offence, which, bearing in mind when you're dealing with papier, there's a requirement that you need to notify as soon as reasonably possible. There is now going to be a prescriptive time period under the Cybercrimes Bill. The Cybercrimes Bill also contemplates that they will, out of the cybercrimes, which or the offences which have been set out, they will designate specific offences which will have to be reported within the 72-hour window frame. But we don't know as yet which ones, which offences are contemplated to fall within this hour frame. You also need to preserve any evidence which you may have in your possession in relation to the commission of a cybercrime. You need to be able to keep this information and preserve it so that when the South African Police Services or any investigative authority comes out to investigate, they will be able to access this information. And any failure by a business to comply with this obligation is a criminal offence in itself, and the company will be liable to a fine of up to 50,000 rand. Moving on to the further slide, additional obligations is that if you as a company are a victim to a cybercrime, or you have an employee who has committed a cybercrime, you have to cooperate and assist with law enforcement in their investigations. And this cooperation can go as far as being assisting them from a technical point of view, allowing them access to your systems, complying with search warrants, keeping information which may be vital to them, and assisting them in any way which is possible or which they may require. Again, if you fail to comply with this requirement, you can be found guilty of an offence, and there's a punishment of a fine or jail sentence of up to 2 years, or you can have both a fine as well as jail sentence imposed on you. Finally, moving on to the next slide, from a practical point of view, at some of the examples that have happened from a cybercrime perspective recently, the most noticeable overseas recently is that of the EasyJet cyber attack. And in this instance, there was the information of over 9 million customers, which was basically obtained by a third party. The information comprised the email addresses, their travel details, their credit and debit card details. And this information hack basically happened over the period from October of 2019 until March of 2020. Whilst EasyJet became aware of it in January of 2020, and they notified customers who had credit card information that had been accessed in April of 2020, they only went public and in May of 2020 to tell basically all remaining people that there had been this attack on them and information had been leaked. The information which was obtained included your CVC details at the back of a credit card. And to date, we understand there have been, I think about 51,000 accesses or instances where that information or that data has actually been used by the parties that were able to hack the information. The Information Commissions Officer, the UK Information Officer, has been notified and is investigating the complaint. And it's imperative to note that under the GDPR, the fine which has been imposed can go up to 4% of its annual worldwide turnover of the EasyJet group, or 17 million rand, whichever is the highest of the two. And it's also pertinent to note that under the EasyJet scenario, and very similar to what has been proposed from a Papier perspective by the information regulator in relation to the most recent attack in South Africa, was that of the so-called class action. And in actual fact, there's been 10,000 applicants that have joined this class action for the EasyJet litigation. And it's estimated that if this goes ahead, the EasyJet will be contemplating a fine or additional penalties of up to 18 billion rand as a result of class action that can be instituted against them. So it's evident that a cyber attack can have massive consequences for a company from not only a reputational point of view, but also from a financial point of view. Another scenario is that of the, Federico, if you can move to the next slide, please, is the British Airways debacle, which was in 2018, where more than 500,000 customers' information was hacked. And there the ICO issued a fine of 183.39 million as a result of the cyber attack. And again, there is litigation class, civil action class litigation, which has been instituted, and it's contemplated that customers could lodge claims for up to 3 billion rand. So the reality is cybercrime security is very important. Cyber attacks are becoming more and more prevalent. From a South African perspective, if we look at Liberty, where there was a phishing hack in 2019, a ransomware hack in 2019, if we look at Life Healthcare, where there was a cyber attack in June of 2020 this year, it is becoming more and more common. The information that is being obtained can have massive implications, not only from a reputational point of view, but also in terms of damages claims, which a company can be facing with. And as we pointed out, you need to be cognizant that the Cyber Crimes Bill is going hand in hand with Papier in it's making criminalizing certain defined parameters of cybercrime offenses, and is also imposing additional obligations from a reporting point of view, as well as from security measures you need to have in place and reporting plans that you need to have in place. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Indeed, Tracy, there is one specific question. And it relates to the question around the worldwide or the global, the turnover, annual global turnover, whether that actually covers and deals with, and the question reads, does worldwide turnover include subsidiaries or group companies? And which obviously is an important question to understand the extent of the impact. So I don't know whether the cyber bill talks about that. I know from an EU perspective that it is not deemed as the group, but in fact the entity itself.
So the Cyber Crimes Bill doesn't at the moment have any reference to that in it. You never know with when they're debating anything further, but you're correct from the EU perspective. And that is what they looked at in the case of EasyJet as well, what they're contemplating.
So what we've decided as a Worksman's team is that we will, through our marketing department, put a document together that focuses on frequently asked questions or interesting questions to consider and contemplate from a papier perspective. And we will be publishing that as part of the legal briefs publications that Worksmans brings out and publishes once a month. So we will collate that and make that available. I note there are no other questions. So I would like to thank everyone this morning for their attendance. As Worksmans, we hope that it's been insightful, that it's been interesting. And we want to just raise the awareness around papier and the implications of papier and how we should think about papier and start to implement papier. Because if we consider papier, it is not only a business process mapping exercise. It's actually an exercise in terms of which we need to contemplate carefully what it means. And not only in terms of what the reading of papier, but understand what happens in the rest of the world and specifically the EU. We've had the recently Screams decision 2 published by or judgment in the EU. That's got a significant impact for transborder data transfer. We need to think about this. We need to determine how that impacts our relationships with entities, whether it's responsible parties or operators within the US. How will we actually ensure that personal information is protected? And we need to unpack that and understand that. We hope you enjoyed this morning. We wish you well, we wish you health, and we look forward to the next webinar series, Data Privacy Webinar Series, which we intend to host during the month of November. And we want to consider specifically what's happening on this African continent of ours when it comes and when we look at data protection and cybersecurity. Have a good day. Thank you, everyone.